This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Despite the fact that it took a Supreme Court ruling in the Swan versus Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education case to desegregate Charlotte's public schools, this city handled integration fairly well. In fact, we handled it better than most southern cities. Charlotte-Mecklenburg integrated their schools largely through the use of busing, moving students around town to achieve racially balanced schools. But that was in 1971, and in the intervening years, we've changed course. Today, schools have essentially resegregated to nearly pre-1971 levels, and there is a chorus of people who believe this is dangerously unhealthy. That includes our guests this hour. So we're going to talk about why this resegregation has occurred, what factors are at play, and what, if anything, can or should be done about it. We're joined by Rosalind Mickelson, Stephen Smith, and Amy Nelson. Collectively, they are the editors of the book Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, School Desegregation and Resegregation in Charlotte. Individually, Rosalind Arlen Mickelson is a professor of sociology, public policy, and women and gender studies at UNC Charlotte. And because of her contributions to teaching and research and her influence nationally, she was recently named UNC Charlotte University Professor. It's a title that you may not be familiar with because I certainly wasn't. It's kind of an Uber professor title. Is that right?
Something of that nature,
well,
yes.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the program. Stephen Smith is professor of political science at Winthrop University. Thank you for being here. And Amy Hahn Nelson is Director of Social Research for the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute and Director of the Institute for Social Capital. Incidentally, all three of our guests will be signing their book tonight from 6:30 to 8 at Park Road Books. Now, before we talk about the topic, I want to talk about the three of you, because we have a UNC Charlotte faculty member, we have a UNC Charlotte Urban Institute employee, and we have a professor from Winthrop University. How do you all know each other?
I know Steve because he is my spouse as well as my colleague. I know Amy because when she entered her doctoral program in the UNC Charlotte Urban Education PhD program, we met, she took classes, and the rest is history.
Yes, we've been colleagues for several years.
Okay, so we have spouses and a relationship, a student-faculty relationship from years ago. So, Amy, let me start with you. You participated in the integration of CMS schools because you were a student there. You graduated in 1997 from South Meck High School. By the time you started, it would seem to me, though, integration was well underway in the CMS system. What was that experience like for you?
It's a really important distinction to say that, you know, my experience was unique because it was not politically charged at all. In 1984, when I entered into kindergarten, that was actually the year of a report called Making Desegregation Work. It was a tale of four cities, and we were one of the four cities highlighted nationally saying that we were making it work here in Charlotte. And that wasn't just southern cities, that was nationally. So my experience was really different. You know, I often describe it to people as kind of fish in water. I didn't know that I was in desegregated schools. I thought that all schools were 60% white, 40% black. In fact, I didn't realize it until I graduated from college and went to teach in Baltimore City. And I walked into my first classroom in Baltimore, and my classroom was 100% African American. And I remember being very confused, frankly. I mean, I know that sounds very naive and stupid in hindsight, but it was this big aha moment of, wow, what I had growing up was really unique and really special, but I did not recognize it. And my peers, you know, my husband's also a graduate. He says the same thing.
And part of the reason for the success of integration here is not only the fact that we took it under our wing and did what we were told and tried to make the best of a situation that could have been terrible if we hadn't made the best of it, but also because of the geography of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system. Although we have an urban school district, it's really an urban suburban school district, which made it easier to integrate. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Stephen and Rosalind, you both arrived in Charlotte in 1985. You enrolled your children in CMS schools. Both of you studied desegregation in Charlotte as part of your academic careers, looking into the social context of schooling and urban politics. You both served as expert witnesses when the court revisited the Swan versus Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education and vacated their previous decision. That reversal ended busing to achieve racial integration. Is that what has led to the resegregation of our schools, that decision?
That decision is part of it, but that decision is one element in a constellation of decisions that were made over several decades.
Beginning around 1984, coincidentally, when Amy started studying, the district began drifting towards resegregation. The school board and the community made a lot of decisions that basically undermined desegregation.
And why did they do that? Because as Amy mentioned, we used to tout our success. We were a national role model, and we didn't hide it. We shined a light on it. So why did we begin to change course?
Well, partially it was because even though desegregation fueled development, whenever there was a conflict between the two, development triumphed. For example, the location of the Outer Belt, where CMS built new schools to accommodate residential growth. CMS very frequently had to violate its own policy about where to build schools because it did not have the money to buy land in more expensive and more easily desegregatable locations.
What role, if any, did your testimony before the court play in their ultimate decision to say busing is no longer needed in Charlotte-Mecklenburg?
Busing ended in 1991. The court vacated SWAN in 1999. Between 91 and 99, CMS was still under court order. It used magnet schools, voluntary participation in magnet schools, as the core strategy for desegregation. That is what the 99 decision ended. And my testimony was completely ignored by Judge Potter, and I believe Steve's testimony was also ignored. However, the appeals court noted Steve's testimony.
Yeah, because my testimony involved the location of the schools, and CMS building schools in a location that could not be desegregated in violation of its own policy. And one of the reasons the three-judge panel of the appeals court reversed part of Judge Potter's decision was that it involved the issues of where the schools were located.
When this happened, we talked about it on this program. Prior to that, we talked about this on other programs that I have done in the city. As a result of the decision, the court decided that Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools had achieved what was known as unitary status. For those people who don't remember or who were not here at the time, that meant that CMS had eliminated much of the dual system, or the mandated segregation of schools, as we feasibly could have done. The school argued, however, the school system argued in the court case that that was not the case, that they had not achieved unitary status, and they needed to continue on that road, and the court decided against that. Why would the court decide against something that the school system itself was saying, we have not yet achieved, we shouldn't change course?
Well, there are several reasons for that. The most cynical is perhaps that the judge involved in the case, Judge Potter, had been active in Charlotte's anti-busing movement when he was a private citizen. So that's probably the most cynical reason. I think the other reason, less cynical, is that the court thought that desegregation had been achieved and all the vestiges of the dual system had been eliminated to the extent practicable. The CMS school system disagreed. It presented a concrete plan to deal further with desegregation, and the judge thought that was not practicable.
The first two sentences in your book pretty much tell the whole story. You write, few school reforms have been as fully implemented and successful as the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools desegregation plan, yet 40 years after the plan was first implemented, the school system has largely resegregated by race and class. Could CMS have maintained its level of integration success despite this ruling if it had wanted to?
I believe the answer is it could have made, yes, it could have made different decisions that would have resulted in a far less racially and socioeconomically segregated system. The desegregation plan was not a failure. The district rejected its success, and the decisions that were made following the 1999 decision set in motion a series of actions that made it extremely difficult, but not impossible, and that is part of the story.
So I said that we had resegregated to near 1971 levels prior to the original Swan versus Board of Education decision. So what are those levels? What is the makeup of the schools today? Do we know? Does anybody know?
Yes.
Amy?
So right now, the demographics of the district have changed tremendously. I mean, I can talk from when I was in school as a student, it was generally 60% white, 40%. And back then, they actually categorized it as non-white. So I think that's important. That was how the court case was. That's how the levels were evaluated. I think it is important to note now that those demographics have dramatically shifted. We're now 54% students who qualify for free reduced lunch. So the poverty rate in our district has increased dramatically. We're also around, I think we're 32% white as well. We're never going to have the levels that we had before, and that's certainly not what we're advocating for.
We are talking about the resegregation of Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools this morning on Charlotte Talks. How long did it take for the system to go back to those levels? Did it start before the reversal of the court's decision? It had already begun at that point.
There was a drift beginning around 1984.
Does the drift drive the drift? In other words, if this begins to reverse, is it like a snowball? Did it chase people away because we began to see increased poverty in the public schools and therefore white parents took flight? Is it kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Well,
I think more recently that's the case. I think early on that was not the case. I think it was primarily what drove it early on in the 80s and 90s was initially where new schools were built, the school district's violation of its own policy about building schools in locations that could be easily desegregated. And then the Magnet Plan also increased resegregation. Mm. If you look at the data, you'll see there's a jump in resegregation when the Magnet Plan goes into effect.
Well, a cynic might say that's why the Magnet Plan was put into effect.
Dean.
Is that accurate?
It's one of the reasons. One of the reasons that John Murphy was...
He was superintendent of schools at one time.
Was lauded by many, many of the civic and corporate leaders when he instituted the Magnet Plan in lieu of mandatory busing was that it was satisfying the loud voices that were complaining.
You talk about the loud voices, and they were complaining about busing, but on the first page of your book, you talk about President Reagan coming to town for a campaign stop in 1984, and he made a statement in his speech denouncing busing. He said it was a failed social experiment that nobody wants. And after he said that, even though his speech was enthusiastically greeted during most of it, that met with a stony silence. How did we go from that to people clamoring for the end of busing? Why the sudden flip?
Well, part of it was development brought to Charlotte many newcomers from other parts of the country. They were accustomed to racially homogeneous school districts, smaller school districts, and they were the ones initially who led the charge against desegregation. For example, if you look at the plaintiffs in the 1999 case, the white plaintiffs who brought the suit to eliminate busing and desegregation, four of them had moved to Charlotte, I think, within the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. I think only one of them was a native Southerner. Mm-hmm. By contrast, the people who wanted to continue the desegregation plan, both of them were native Charlatans, native North Carolinians, one of whom was a native Charlatan.
Stephen Smith is a professor of political science at Winthrop University. His wife, Roswell Mickelson, is professor of sociology and public policy and women and gender studies at UNC Charlotte. And Amy Nelson is director of social research at the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute and the director of the Institute for Social Capital. Collectively, they have written a book about the desegregation and resegregation of Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. We'll come back in just a moment and talk more. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The book we're talking about is about Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. It's about us. Yesterday, today, and tomorrow, school desegregation and resegregation in Charlotte, edited by our guests today, Roslyn Mickelson, Stephen Smith, and Amy Hahn Nelson, all with universities, University of North Carolina, Charlotte, and also with Winthrop University. We were talking just before the break about shifting demographics and newcomers coming in, which kind of changed the tenor of the conversation and the attitude about busing. We kind of resigned ourselves. I don't think anybody really loved busing, but we kind of resigned ourselves. We saw that it worked and did integrate the schools, but newcomers began to arrive, and they didn't like it very much, and they pushed for an end to this. The shifting demographics of Charlotte. Talk about that, Amy.
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that in the 1990s, you know, our population in our county was around 500,000 people, and now we are approaching 1 million people. So just in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, we've had this population explosion. The rate of African Americans in the district has remained fairly steady during this time, but the big change has come with the growth of Latinos. We're considered a Latino hypergrowth. Sydney, I know that you've had several shows about that.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot of work around this topic at UNC Charlotte and the Urban Institute. We've also had a 600% increase in the number of Asians in the city. So that really changes the demographics of our school building. And I think it's also important when talking about demographics to talk about private school enrollment. Our private school enrollment in our county has actually stayed steady for decades. It stays around 14%. And if you want to dig into any of this deeper, if you just go into Google and type in QOL, Quality of Life Dashboard, it is a study that comes out of UNC Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, and City of Charlotte. And all these numbers are there. There's actually a metric of, you know, rate of private school enrollment, and you can look at that down to the granular level.
So when the original desegregation decision was reached, it was a black-white decision.
Yes.
Today, it is not a black-white decision. It is a multiracial ethnic makeup, and we do have a major influx of Asians and Latinos along with African-Americans in the school population along with whites. So given the influx of Asians and Latinos into this equation, could it be argued that we are integrated?
We are different. We are not integrated in the sense of the population that attends schools reflecting the demographic population of the community. And that is the measure.
Meaning that white people are missing from the equation?
No. It means that where people go to school, the racial makeup of the schools that children attend,
mm-hmm.
does not reflect the overall community's racial makeup, in the sense that during the time we were operating under SWAN, we sought to have 60% white and others and 40% black, because that was roughly what the district was. Today, there are schools that are hyper-segregated black, hyper-segregated Latino. There are schools that are
hyper-segregated white.
And the spatial demographics of these schools doesn't reflect the city.
So what you're saying is everybody's coming into the system. Everybody's allowed into the system, and they end up where they end up, not because we have moved them around the system for racial balance within each building of the school system, but simply because that's the neighborhood school, and that neighborhood is white, that neighborhood is Latino, that neighborhood is African American, and that's the reflection of what's going on in the school.
Exactly. Very well said.
So none of this would mean anything, I suppose, if you folks and others did not think that this was a bad thing. And you all say, all three of you say, that this resegregation is detrimental to students, the learning experience, and to society. In the book, you say that desegregation benefited both black and white students academically, but especially African Americans. How so?
For the last 10, 15 years, I have been reviewing the social behavior and educational research on the question of, does the racial and socioeconomic composition of schools make a difference in outcomes? And the answer is definitively yes. It turns out that going to diverse schools is positively related to higher test scores and better grades, to graduating from high school for attending college, and graduating from college for all children, not just for children of color and poor children, but they're the ones who benefit the most, because they are harmed the most from going to racially isolated high poverty schools. Attending a diverse school promotes achievement across the curriculum.
Why?
Oh, that is a program unto itself. But basically,
we're here every day.
And I'm here. But briefly, schools that are diverse and have diverse teachers and children in them trigger higher order thinking skills. They typically have better resources. The school climate in which children learn is more academically positive. And when you have a high-poverty school, you have a lot of turnover in children because poor people move a lot. You have the least seasoned or qualified teachers. And so there is a snowball effect where the children who attend the high-poverty, racially isolated schools get the least opportunities to learn.
So your studies, your research has shown that. Other people's research Absolutely. Has shown that.
Absolutely.
But you quote in your book Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who does not believe in affirmative action, as saying that the social science evidence on the question of educational effects of diverse schooling is inconclusive and that there is no empirical foundation to argue that integrated schools are a compelling state interest. You say he is flat wrong.
Yes.
Is that willful ignorance, or is he simply not in possession of the facts?
I would offer, I don't know why he said it, but I believe it is because he's not in possession of the facts. But putting aside that issue, sometimes Supreme Court opinions are not based in research, they're on points of law. But let me tell you why I believe he's not in possession of the facts. The amicus briefs that were filed in the 2007 case.
And the amicus briefs are?
Are the friend of the court documents that outside parties send to the Supreme Court to express their view of the upcoming case.
Okay.
The briefs that were submitted by those who wished to end desegregation relied on old, outdated evidence and research, and they essentially made the case that, see, this research that is pre-1990s doesn't support a conclusive evidence. The supporters of desegregation used evidence through the new century and the new millennium, and it shows that definitively that diverse schools are a much more efficient and effective way to teach all children.
So you have said that diversity in the schools helps African Americans and other minorities to achieve at the levels of white students. It brings the whole, it's a rising tide, all the boats go up. But there are people out there who would say that being in a school with underprivileged students who are behind because they don't have the advantages of affluent white children mm-hmm. make the white children in the classroom suffer academically. You say that's not true either.
Correct.
Not true at all.
Correct. The evidence.
How do you explain that? Why do they excel as well?
Well, I can speak for myself okay. All right. as a white child and a white student. I mean, there are many benefits. There are academic benefits, and there's a strong literature around this as well. And I think going to Roz's point around the methodological, well, just the methods of these studies. So the previous studies looking at this were only able to use samples of students. But with the data available now around education, there's actually studies looking at populations of students. So you're looking at every single child in a state. And you can break this down and you control for things like free reduced lunch status. And you can control for, you know, different demographic pieces. And what those studies show is that all children benefit, including people like me growing up who was white. I'm from an upper middle class background, and I definitely benefited from being in diverse schools. And the literature is consistent with my experience.
Now, one of the hopes of integration when it began in the late 60s, early 70s here in Charlotte was that we would expose young people to each other. Blacks, whites, now Latinos, Asians, etc., would learn about each other. We would build social capital with these young people, that they would see that they had more in common than they had differences. And that could then be extrapolated out as these kids left school, graduated from college, or went into the workforce, and it would change the character of our neighborhoods and hopefully eliminate the need for busing, because the neighborhoods would then be greatly integrated, because we went to school with each other, we know each other, we like each other, the differences aren't that great. Sure, move in next to me. That didn't happen. Because that's, well, it did to a degree, but we have segregated schools because the schools are neighborhood schools now, and the neighborhoods are segregated. So talk to me about, was this a failed experiment?
Not at all. I mean, even one of the reviewers of our book points out, and we agree, we love the statement because we agree with it, is that desegregation was a rejected success. There is a literature.
Rejected success.
There is a literature saying that graduates of, and I found this in my own research, looking at, so my research looks at long-term outcomes of students in desegregated schools. And by long-term outcomes, I mean 10, 15 years post-graduation. Mm-hmm. And one of the outcomes that I found in my research, which is also consistent with the literature around this, is that graduates of desegregated schools are more likely to work and live in diverse environments. I mean, I myself grew up on South Charlotte. I live in East Charlotte now by choice. And there are many of my classmates who have made the same choices.
So it has worked to a degree, but not to the degree that
in
this, perhaps.
And to a degree. I mean, there are many reasons why people make the housing choices they do, especially people my age. My generation has, you know, we have young children. So schooling is it's huge problem. I mean, I know, for example, my school district is one of the lowest performing, that my elementary school for my neighborhood is one of the lowest performing schools in the state. Because it is hyper-segregated. It is, you know, high 90% non-white. People in my generation, we make housing decisions based on school decisions. And so it becomes this just chicken or the egg situation over and over again. I think we're seeing that throughout our city.
When the original Swan v. Board of Education decision was reached, Charlotte was not told how to achieve integration. They were just told to do it. And we embraced it, and we did it. And what they did was they divided schools up. I think K through 3 schools were located in predominantly white neighborhoods in which black children were bused. Grades 4 through 6 were located in black neighborhoods to which white students were bused. And then the junior and high school footprints were regional, more regional, so to speak. So they really didn't have to do all that much busing or assign them to certain neighborhoods. Were there significant objections to that among parents in the system or among politicians?
There were some objections, but I think as part of Charlotte coming together to make the busing plan work, people accepted that. For example, our children were bused from our neighborhood to First Ward. We lived in an outlying neighborhood, predominantly white. So for grades K through 3, black children were bused to our neighborhood. For 4 through 6, our children were bused to First Ward. And we had no problem with it. I think most of our neighbors were very pleased with the arrangement because First Ward was such a great school.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to note two things. One, my mother responds to this when I asked her about this years ago. She said, you know, Amy, it was just what you did. You know, you didn't question it. It was just what you did. The other point here is that I think it's really important when you talk about this part of our desegregation history that we acknowledge that the students of color in our district and the families of color, they had a tremendous burden that my family, as a white family, didn't have. You know, I was bused to majority black part of town. I was bused to Behringer Elementary from South Charlotte 3 years. And that was considered this, you know, huge issue for a lot of families, supposedly. Yet it's important to note that my classmates who lived on West Charlotte, because we were together through K-12 and 13 years of schooling, they were bused for 9 years. Mm-hmm. So I think too often we don't recognize that part of our history here locally to say that we were not equal in how we dealt with busing. So we're not, when we say, you know, to highlight the experience of Charlotte, we're in no way looking through rose-colored glasses. We acknowledge there were large fundamental problems with the way that we did it, but we, you know, we are saying that it deserves a second look.
We're talking about the desegregation and the resegregation of Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. It's all outlined in our guest book, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, School Desegregation and Resegregation in Charlotte. This morning on Charlotte Talks. You wanted to chime in there.
I think it's important to highlight the fact that desegregation and racially and socioeconomically diverse schools are a very effective reform strategy for improving education for everybody. But educational outcomes include not only academic, but the non-academic. And the research about Charlotte and around the country indicate that attending diverse schools reduces prejudice and fears in all directions. It increases cross-racial trust and friendship. It enhances capacity for multicultural navigation. It creates children who are avoiding the criminal justice system. And that is why the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the U.S. military supports desegregated schools. They filed Friends of the Court brief when the University of Michigan was arguing in favor of affirmative action. And in fact, the chief of police of Charlotte, Daryl Stevens, was one of the signers of a Friend of the Court brief in support of keeping school desegregation in Louisville and in Seattle, because he said that desegregated school, he and his colleagues said that desegregated schools were a very effective tool in keeping children in school, graduating, and out of the juvenile justice system. And so what we need to consider is the point that Amy made, that as children leave the school system and enter the workforce, they are going to be in a world that is not one social class and one race. We live in a multi-ethnic, globalized society and an economy, and people must learn the set of skills for being effective as a member of this society, both as a citizen, as a worker, and as a parent.
We're going to talk in the next segment about the fact that there are dividends that this pays long-term for society at large, some of which you've already mentioned here. But is there a price to pay for rejecting the success of integration? Quickly.
Immense price. Immense price. First of all, the compensatory programs that are adopted cost more and they're less effective.
Let me stop you, because you don't have time to answer the question. I'll ask the question again when we come back from the break, and that will give you a chance to expound on that. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Rosalind Mickelson is with us, professor of sociology and public policy and women and gender studies at UNC Charlotte. Stephen Smith, professor of political science at Winthrop University, and Amy Nelson, director of social research at the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. Together, they have written a book called Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, School Desegregation and Resegregation in Charlotte, which is the history of where we have come from and how we got to where we are today and some of the things that we're going to feel as a result of this. Rosalind has made a very good case for the positives that come from school desegregation. But I want to ask Stephen, because you're the political scientist here, and we're going to talk later on about some more of the positives and how it affects society at large. What is the price to pay? Is there a price to pay for not doing this, for rejecting integration?
Well, there's an immense price. First of all, because some schools are hyper-segregated by class and race, educational authorities authorize the spending of more money on these schools. That costs more money, and there's a lot of research that shows that desegregation not only has better educational outcomes, but it's less expensive than all these compensatory programs. So in many ways, desegregation is less expensive than trying to deal with hyper-segregated schools and dealing with these hyper-segregated schools by providing additional funding. Mm. The other price is that we're much more concerned, so to speak, not about justice, but just us. There's a mindset that says, it's just us, I'm just concerned about what's best for me and my friends, rather than thinking about what's best for the whole community.
Well, the whole country seems to be going in that direction. Did it start with this? Is this the tip of the spear, or is this just a little jagged edge of the tip of the spear?
I think it's part and parcel of the same thing. I mean, it's hard to know what starts it and what doesn't start it, but it's a package, and it's hard to unwrap the whole package.
And part of the argument by those who would like to see all this unravel and have done a good job of doing that, I suppose, is that the schools are broken. They're broken and they can't be fixed. The public schools are broken. You say that simply is not true. Why is it not true?
It just isn't true. The data doesn't support it. And it's something that I hear in the community quite a bit.
So what is true?
Well, I think that a lot of people have experiences in their schools, and they take one experience or set of experiences, and then they make that the experience, right? But when you look at a big picture around educational outcomes, education's working. There is literature and there is evidence that public schools actually have better outcomes than private schools. There's
really?
A nationally...
Why don't we know that? That's the first I've heard that.
Well,
why don't we know that?
There's a great book that everyone should go get out of the library. It's called The Public School Advantage, right?
Lubianski? That's right. Chris and Sarah Lubianski, who are sociologists at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, have written a book called Public School Advantage, and they...
Lay
it all out.
And they use a nationally representative sample. I mean, the data set they use is expansive. And it's data that, frankly, wasn't available, 10, 15 years ago. A lot of the research has gotten so much better because the data is there. Before, it wasn't collected, and No Child Left Behind changed a lot of that.
Well, let's talk about No Child Left Behind. You point out that neither No Child Left Behind or Race to the Top considers race or racial integration in any way, and in fact, one of those programs, Race to the Top, encourages the development of charter schools, which you say are typically more segregated than traditional public schools. Do you see anything malicious there, or in the state legislature's decision, for instance, to eliminate the cap on charter schools, which you say will push CMS to further segregate? Some would say that the push to charter schools is a deliberate effort to increase segregation.
Well, I have an interesting perspective on this. I used to actually...
Or to hurt the public schools. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I actually used to work at a charter school. I feel like I need to disclose that. I was a school leader at a charter school here in Charlotte. I think charters are an interesting idea, and I think it's a concept that, like any concept, can go a lot of different directions. There are some charters here in town that are very diverse, both racially and socioeconomically and geographically. Charters are interesting because they're countywide. They're not it's not a small geographic area. The other place which
charters... So they could end up being more integrated.
Exactly. If it's a component of the selection, which it could be. And there is actually one charter that opened last year. It was a selection. It was an aspect of the charter, was diversity. Unfortunately, the way that charters have kind of shaken out in our county, and I won't talk about the state, but in our county, they are the most segregated schools. We have hyper-segregated charter schools that we have 90-some percent non-white, and then we had 90-some percent white charter schools here in our county. And some have even gone as far to say that some of our charter schools, they are reminiscent of the segregation academies of the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Adam emails, what role do charter schools and religious private schools play in resegregating CMS? I think, he says, they play a huge role, along with a lot of whites moving to Union County for, quote, better schools, unquote, which means less blacks. West Charlotte was mostly black, and I got a great education there. There was prior to the recession, when this city was growing so fast, they could not build schools fast enough, and they couldn't build houses fast enough. A lot of houses were going up in Union County, and one of the advertising slogans used by the builders was, better schools. Is that a code word?
Yes.
And ironically, Union County recently has undergone a tremendous political turmoil over the redistricting of boundaries for schools, because it has experienced tremendous growth, and the county schools and the city schools have very different demographics, with lots of Latino students in the city schools around Monroe, and there was even some very public fights over the student assignment plan. So the escape to Union County is not turning out to be the dream that many people who went there for that purpose envisioned.
If, as you say, integrated schools help all the students in them rise, they do better. They do better than they would in a segregated environment. Now that the schools have resegregated, so to speak, have we seen a decline in achievement among students who are in fundamentally segregated school environments now?
That's a very excellent question. Overall, achievement is improving in the district, and we want to take our hats off to the educators who have sweated blood to achieve these goals, and the parents and the kids who have worked hard.
And the leadership has made fundamental decisions to keep the achievement high. And, I mean, CMS is one of the premier urban school districts in the nation. And that's something many people in our community don't know and don't
refuse to believe in many cases.
And I think this comes back to the whole issue of the fiction that the schools are failing.
It's not true.
It is not. There are some schools that are failing, and the lift zone corridor is prima facie evidence of that.
But if they are they failing because we have handicapped them? We have removed integration as a tool to raise all boats.
Yes, exactly, exactly. That is. I would say that is the fundamental structural reason for the challenges in the Project Lift Zone. And I'm not talking about the poverty or concentration. I'm just saying that the decisions that the school system has made as to how it's going to assign students to schools and educators to schools is a big part of this. But before I want to say that when we say that public schools are not failing, we are talking about the broad brushstroke claim. We are not denying that there are schools that are very, very seriously challenged. But the majority of schools are really good and some are excellent.
What role has the growing economic divide in this country between the haves and the have-nots played in all of this, if any?
Well, a huge role. In fact, the achievement gap on socioeconomic status now is greater than the achievement gap on race. In other words, there's historically been a racial achievement gap. There's also historically been a socioeconomic achievement gap. Now the socioeconomic achievement gap is greater than the racial gap.
Hmm. And most poor children in the country are white. And that's something that we need to keep in mind. We're talking about Charlotte today, but the issues that we are engaging are true of public education in schools around the country. And so it's very, very important that we not define school diversity only in terms of race. We need to include the issue of socioeconomic status as well, because that is a major part of
one way to alleviate the resegregation in Charlotte would be to take socioeconomic status into account. Nothing in the 1999 order, vacating the Swan order, would have prohibited the school board from taking socioeconomic status into account and assigning students considering that factor.
So we could bus kids based on socioeconomic
just like factor. Raleigh does.
We've bused children to segregate our schools, we bused children to desegregate our schools, and we bus children now. I'm in the third smallest neighborhood in the city, and there are 10 school buses that go through my streets every day. So we bus, it's not about busing.
Well, they said, I remember this saying, that when the order came down to end busing for integration, they weren't going to sell the buses. They were still going to bus children everywhere. So I don't understand what really happened there.
Well, that's because the North Carolina has a law that says children who live a certain distance from a school are entitled to transportation, and if they live across a dangerous highway, they're entitled to transportation, and if they're involved in certain educational programs, they receive transportation. And equating desegregation with busing busing is a tool to accomplish a goal. And that is something that we need to keep in mind.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk a little bit about foundations, the role of private and philanthropic foundations in shaping educational policy here and around the country. These foundation and think tanks include the Broad Foundation, of which former CMS Superintendent Peter Rulick was a board member, an award-winning board member, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which influences a lot of things other than just education, Foundation for the Carolinas, the C.D. Spangler Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Walton Foundation. Each of these make money available to school districts who uphold the values and practices that these various foundations have decided are best. Now, there's no one forcing these districts to take this money, but they do take the money because they need the money. What has been the influence of all of this?
We have seen the direction of school reform leaning toward market-inspired solutions instead of equity-inspired solutions in the absence of any...
What does that mean?
It means...
The market knows best?
Yes, that competition and choice and standards and holding people accountable
But isn't that true? Isn't holding people accountable good? Isn't having standards good?
Absolutely. And it's all the devil is in the details about how that's implemented. That becomes the center of gravity of the reforms rather than a vision of equity and excellence for all. When we see the direction that our country is moving. For example, the Race to the Top competition that's coming out of the Department of Education until recently didn't include equity in its decision-making about who is going to get grants. So what happens is the values of these business-oriented groups become the values of the driving the reforms.
We're talking about the book Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, School Desegregation and Resegregation in Charlotte, with the three people who compiled the book here on Charlotte Talks this morning. Let's talk about something else, and that is the benefit to society of these integrated groups. You say that desegregation is associated with lower probability of involvement with the criminal justice system, and that with the resegregation within CMS, black males' likelihood of involvement with the criminal justice system has increased.
Yes.
Where does that statistic come from?
My colleague at UNC Charlotte, Stephen Billings, and his associates have done some research that has demonstrated that, and hats off to these gentlemen for their excellent research. Mm-hmm. The end of busing and desegregation in Charlotte in 2002 set up a natural experiment where we can look at the outcomes before the end of SWAN and after the end of SWAN. And so there's been a whole host of research on this. One of the outcomes is increased criminal justice involvement among young black males, lower achievement among those who are in segregated schools. Other things include
increased residential segregation. Earlier you asked about residential segregation. Mm-hmm. The natural experiment also shows that once CMS stopped taking race into account, that facilitated residential segregation.
And the benefit of integrated schools, aside from higher achievement on the part of all students, black, white, and otherwise, you say higher graduation rates,
yes,
less involvement with criminal activity, greater employability with higher earnings, all the results of integration. That means less cost and greater benefit to society. Why aren't we embracing this?
That's another program. But I think that there are opportunities if we as a community take a hard look at what we want. Do we want our children and grandchildren to grow up in a society where half the kids are illiterate and or functionally innumerate and illiterate, or do we want a society where everybody is well equipped to be a student and a worker and a citizen?
Rosalind Mickelson is professor of sociology and public policy and women and gender studies at UNC Charlotte. Her husband, Stephen Smith, professor of political science at Winthrop University, and Amy Nelson, director of social research at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute and the director for social capital there. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, School Desegregation and Resegregation in Charlotte, the name of their collective book.